The theory consisted of a single complex scalar and a single Weyl fermion or Majorana fermion, whatever you'd like to call it, but it's a two-component fermion. And today we're going to elaborate on this theory and actually calculate some interesting quantities in this theory. But in order so that we just have all the notation uniform, let me just once more write the Lagrangians that we arrived at. So we said that the theory is defined for the following Lagrangian. We have the kinetic term for the scalar, and we have the kinetic term for the fermion. And just so that, again, we're all on the same page, let me remind you that what this notation means is that I'm actually contracting the space-time index mu, right? Mu runs from 0 to 4 or from 0 to 3. And then there are also spinorial indices that sits as alpha dot beta. And so those are contracted against the spinors themselves. Okay? And if you have any, if at any point you're confused about the spinors, just raise your hand and I'm happy to clarify it. All right? So now the other thing we had is, of course, mass terms. So we also had m squared, let's say, phi star phi, right? That's the mass term for the scalar field. And then there is a mass term for the fermionic field, which I'll write as a half m psi alpha psi alpha. And since this is a complex quantity, we need to add to that the Hermitian conjugate, psi bar alpha dot psi bar alpha dot. Okay? And I'm just taking m to be real here, because I could always rotate it. The bar notation just means conjugate. So if you're, this literally just means take the dagger. I just don't want to write dagger everywhere, so I put a bar. It does, there is no gamma zero or anything. There's just that. Okay, so these are the mass terms. And then the last thing we discussed yesterday was the interactions, and we wrote that, well, there is a scalar quartic coupling, which is phi phi star square. And I'll put a 1 over 4 here, which is a combinatorial factor. We'll see later on where it shows up. And then there is also a Yokawa term. Phi, I'll write it as phi star psi psi. And similarly to the mass term, this is a complex quantity, so I should also write half y star phi psi bar, okay? So here is our theory. Are there any questions on this theory? Are there any questions on anything written here? Are you confused about anything? Yeah.
So the 1 over 4 is basically the complex nature of phi?
That's right. So if, that's right. This factor of 4 would have been a factor of 4 factorial if phi was real. And we'll see in a short while where does it actually help. If you're not happy about why there is a factor of 4 here, why there's a factor of half, just wait a little bit and you'll see how it shows up. Yeah.
When anything changes, we add, for example, 5 psi psi or 5 star psi bar psi bar.
5 psi psi.
Basically.
That's right. So you could do that. That will violate some of the symmetry that I have here. So I want to only have those terms. In a sense, I do have some conserved charge here, right? By writing it this way, I make sure that I have some sort of conserved charge. But yeah, in principle, you could add those two. Any other questions on what we have written here? If you're confused now, this would be a good time to ask, because otherwise, not much of what I'll say next will make sense. So we all clear what we're going to discuss? Yeah.
I just want to clarify that it's a plus, it's a minus m squared, not a plus. Yesterday you wrote a plus, so.
This thing?
Does it matter? Yeah.
Yeah, it should be a minus sign.
Okay.
Just because If I wrote plus yesterday, I apologize. It should always be, remember the Lagrangian is basically kinetic term minus potential. And so the potential is anything that is not a kinetic term. It should come with a negative sign if it's a positive quantity. That's also why there is a negative sign in front of the quartic. Okay? So this sort of potential, if I just look at this piece, which we'll discuss later on in the course as well, if you just look at that piece, this is the potential for the scalar, and it looks something like that. Right? It's a quadratic plus a quartic, and they're both positive. If I flip the sign of this m square, then interesting things starts to happen. Right? But for now, we'll keep all the signs positive. Well, it's negative in the Lagrangian, positive in the potential. Any other questions? You're all happy with this Lagrangian? Now, you have all taken quantum field theory. So what is missing from this description? Is there anything else I should be writing down? Anything else I should specify? What are those quantities? Where are they defined? At any energy scale, are they defined? Are they even well defined as I've written them? What is there anything else I should add to my Lagrangian? Have you guys ever seen counter terms? You know what counter terms mean? Where do they show up? Why do we need them? So if you ever get confused about counter terms, we'll go through them now pretty slowly. Basically, the idea is that, well, let me just start doing it, and then as we go along, we'll understand more and more why we need them. But basically, this theory, as we said, is only defined with respect at some scale, right? It's only defined at some particular scale, and we need to specify that scale. And in a sense, those quantities, I should really add to all of them some index zero that says that is the quantity at that scale, and those quantities get renormalized. So when I do my experiments at low energies, that's not the quantity I see. That's not M0 is not the quantity I see. What I see is this quantity called M square. And all those other effects need to get absorbed into some what we call counter terms. Okay? So we need to add to this Lagrangian, to every term I see in the Lagrangian, I add a counter term. Right? So for example, I won't write the whole thing again because it's just copying. But let's just do a few examples. For example, for the scalar term, I'll add to my Lagrangian a term that looks like minus delta m phi square. Right? And for the quartic term, I'll add a term in my Lagrangian that looks like delta lambda phi to the fourth. And if I like, I can add a 1/4. It doesn't matter too much. Okay. Actually, let's just add the 1/4 just for simplicity. What about these ones? Also, the kinetic terms. The kinetic terms also get a term. There is a counter term for the scalar, so it looks something like delta. Let's call it z phi, and that will be di mu phi star di mu phi, right? That's what's known as the wave function counter term. So those are pretty easy. Those are for the scalar. For the fermion, it's pretty much the same thing. You can add a counter term for the fermion Lagrangian. Sorry, there should be a plus sign. I delta z fermion psi bar sigma dot psi. P, sigma dot P, right? And this P is the momentum. If I take the Fourier transform of this, that's where I get the momentum from. And similarly for all the other terms, okay? So I'll have this sort of term for every term I have in my Lagrangian. And maybe even more if I neglected to write some terms. And indeed, we will find out that that's what happened. Which part are we? Ask me. I'm a more reliable source of information.
I just can't read the
this one. So I'm just trying to distinguish between this delta z psi and this delta z phi. Okay? And P here is just the momentum transform of this term.
No I or?
Yeah, thank you. Good. Thanks. Okay? He's saying there is no I because when you take the Fourier transform, the P brings down an I. All right, so now I'm starting to, yeah. So when you compute the two-point function, as we'll do in a moment, the structure of it will be something that is independent of momentum, which has to do with the mass, and something that depends on momentum. And so this piece, or the equivalent for the fermion, I'll have something like that for the fermion, right? For the mass of the fermion, right? I have delta alpha beta. These pieces are absorbing whatever have to do with the mass renormalization. These pieces, sorry, I should also not have, this should be a P square. Those pieces that have to do with momentum have to do with the wave function renormalization. The reason why I'm not writing momentum is because I shouldn't have any, there shouldn't be any field dependence on those things. No, what, I'm confusing you. In the Lagrangian, there, of course, you could write the full, if you like, you could write the full thing. I apologize. Later on, when we actually write the Lagrangian, we won't need this. But for here, we can just write the full. Okay. So for every term in the Lagrangian, you just write a counter term that will absorb some of the infinities that we'll encounter. Okay. So let's see how this is how this helps us. So let's start by trying to compute the simplest diagram. Before we start computing diagrams, so let's now do the Feynman rules associated with this Lagrangian. So all the rules that I will describe to you are referring to this Lagrangian. So the simplest rule is just for the scalar. Now, what does it mean to write phi star phi? Well, what does it mean to even write phi? Phi of x creates a particle at position x, sorry, creates an antiparticle at position x and annihilate a particle. So create an antiparticle, right, and annihilate a particle. This is what phi does. Phi star does the opposite. It annihilates an antiparticle and creates a particle, right? So if we have the operator phi star phi, that's an operator that can create the particle here. The particles then move here and gets annihilated by phi. So this is phi star phi. Right? And the arrow is telling you that you created a particle here, it moved in this direction and got annihilated here. Right? So remember from field theory, the meaning of the field is that something that annihilates particles and creates antiparticles, and the field conjugate is the opposite. Okay? Anyone confused about that part? So you understand why am I putting the arrow this way? It's just that's what designates particles. All right? So this thing just gives me I p squared minus m squared, assuming that I have momentum p flowing in this direction. The fermion is a little more complicated because I actually have two kind of propagations. I have a propagation that has to do with the kinetic term, where I have a fermion bar. So a fermion getting created, propagating this way, and then getting annihilated, right? And this one comes with an index, let's say beta dot, and this is coming with an index alpha. And so that is equal to I sigma alpha beta dot, right, divided by p square minus capital M square, right? So again, the arrow is just telling me that I've created a fermion here because I used the psi bar, and I annihilated the fermion here because I used psi, right? But I have another kind of vertex that has to do with the mass insertion, with the mass operator, yeah. Oh, sorry, thank you. Thanks. Okay, but I have another one where I created a particle here and annihilated it and made it into an antiparticle here and annihilated it. And this is equal to I delta, let's call it M, delta alpha dot beta dot, okay, divided by p square minus m square, okay? And there is similarly one where you take the conjugate of that, all right? Now, we're not going to need all those details a whole lot, but let's just have them out so in case we want to refer to them. Then there is interaction points, right? There is the Yokawa interaction, for example. There is that. This is coming from the operator phi star psi psi. What does this operator mean? It means that at this point, I'm annihilating two particles, so the arrow should be in, and I'm creating phi, so the arrow should be out. Yeah. So sigma bar, so this is what happens when the momentum is flowing this way. If the momentum is flowing the other way, but the arrow is pointing that way, you'll have a sigma bar. So let me write it here. If it's something like, if the diagram is something like that, where the arrow is pointing that way, then that will be I sigma mu p square minus m square. That's right. So this is for this operator, and this is equal, and the Feynman rule for this is just minus I y, right? And if you have the spinorial indices, you'll just have a delta alpha beta. Sorry, this should be upper alpha lower beta. Okay. And then finally, there is, of course, the complex conjugate. This guy is equal to minus I y star delta alpha dot beta dot. And then finally, there is the four-point coupling, right, where I have two fields coming in, phi star, the way I defined it, I want this to be, so here, those are coming in, so that's a phi, right, and those are coming out, so that's a phi star. So here, what I mean by that is just not which field is coming out, but rather which field is being used on this in this vertex to annihilate this incoming guy, okay? So for this one, I'm using the phi here, and I'm using the phi here. And for this one, I'm using the phi star to create a particle. And for this one, I'm using the phi star to create a particle. That's why it's all coming out. All right, so those are the rules. If you're confused about exactly why it's coming out, why it's coming in, just come talk to me afterwards and I can show it to you in more detail. But when we actually write diagrams, we'll know which one to use exactly. So this is equal to minus I lambda. All right, so now you have the Feynman rules. And for each of those Feynman rules, there is a associated Feynman rule for the counter terms. Right? You basically write the same thing, but with a counter term. And maybe you can do it in the tutorial. So now let's try to use those Feynman rules in actually computing a diagram. Yeah. This one? Yeah, so this one, it's a little tricky because what you're doing here is that you're using the operator, where is it? The mass operator psi psi, right? So, or psi dagger, where you can annihilate, you can create, if you like, you can if you add a particle coming from here, you can create it with psi bar, and then it's flipped because in this theory, there's no notion of particle and antiparticle. Every particle is on antiparticle, right? And so you can flip and make a particle into an antiparticle and then annihilate it. So this is the special thing about Majorana fermions, which you're probably not used to yet, is that if I didn't have the mass term for the fermions, then there is a good notion of what a particle is and what an antiparticle is. Because psi annihilates particles, and psi bar creates particles. But in this theory where I have a mass term for the Majorana, there is no notion of particle and antiparticle. A particle is also an antiparticle. So that's why you can and this flipping is exactly what it does. It flips a particle into an antiparticle. Okay? If you're confused about it, we can go over it a little later. But in the limit when the mass term for the fermion goes to zero, then you do recover the notion of particles and antiparticles. All right. So let's do one calculation that will start using those terms. So the simplest kind of things to calculate are just the correlators. Corrections to two-point correlators, or in other words, the corrections to the propagators, to what happens when you create a field here and it propagates to a point here. So how do I do that? Well, the Feynman diagrams for that, in the simplest case, let's take the scalar. This is the zeroth order diagram, right? It just corresponds to this, where I have momentum flowing this way. Can you all see this? Okay, so now, and the arrow is going in this direction. Now, what is the first order correction to this? What kind of diagram will correct this process? What kind of thing I can write? Which of those rules I can use to glue something together to actually correct this diagram? Exactly. So I can have a fermion loop. So I know the arrow is going this way. And now I look up my rules. I see that if an arrow goes this way, the arrows of the fermions are going outwards. So I have that. Right? And then I go again to my dictionary, and I see that I have another one that if I flip it over, I can close this loop, and come out. Right? So here is my diagram. Here is one diagram that corrects it. And we'll compute this diagram in a moment. What other diagram do we have? What other diagram corrects this propagator? Yeah.
You use the four-point.
Yeah. Perfect. So I have another one, which is So I have arrow coming in, arrow coming out, and the thing in between just contracts on itself. Right? So here are my two corrections. And is everyone comfortable with this, or is there anything that you want me to say more about why are we doing these diagrams? We're all good on that? Okay, so let's actually compute. Let's start by computing this one because it's the easiest. And then we'll do this one because it's a little more involved. There are more indices. All right, so well, hopefully you can all still see it. So this one, I have momentum coming in. The same momentum has to come out because of momentum conservation. And now I just read the Feynman rules. I don't need to do anything on the external momenta because those are just stripped away. And so I just have to know what's happening in this vertex. So this vertex, I just copy. I get minus I lambda, right? Minus I lambda from this vertex. And then for this propagator, I have an integral over the momentum. There is some momentum running in this loop. Let's call it k. And I integrate over this momentum. And we said we're in d dimensions, so I'll do d for k. And what do I do for the propagator? For the propagator, I just use this prescription, I over p squared minus m squared, but I just have to replace by k squared minus m squared. And in general, there is an I epsilon. Okay? So we're all good on how I got this? You've probably seen it several times in your field theory course. So now what do you do with this integral? Well, a moment, just let's start it for a moment, and we see that if I try to do it in a very naive way, right, I'll do it more precisely in a moment, but if I just do it in a very naive way, d dk goes like k to the, let's say, let's do it in four dimensions just so it's very concrete. It's k cubed dk. Right? And that's equal to, it goes like k square dk square. There's a factor of 2, but let's ignore it. Right? So that means that d4k, k square, goes like just dk square. Because the k square cancels with this k square, and it just goes like dk square. Now that's pretty troubling. Because that means that this integral will give you, will be sensitive to the largest momenta available, right? Because you're basically integrating with you're basically integrating a constant over all momenta. If you integrate a constant over all momenta, you get the highest momenta possible, right? So let's see how this comes about. Let's just do this integral exactly. So as you know from your field theory courses, the first thing you want to do is to actually do a weak rotation, right? You want to change time. So one of those components is time. Let's call it k naught. And the first thing you want to do is to actually do an analytic continuation of that into I k, let's call it k kd, right? And that turns this guy into minus k square, and I get another I from here. So I get a thing at the end. You get I lambda, and we have d dk Euclidean. So now I have Euclidean integral divided by k Euclidean square plus m square, right, plus I epsilon. Right? And this one I can do because you know that Let's just do it in four dimensions. You can do the general formula later on. But this is just equal to the to k to the k cubed dk, right, times d omega, which is the integral over all angle. Right? This is the angular integral in over the three sphere, which in four dimensions, or in the three, for the three sphere is equal to 2 pi square. Right? So we can write this as I lambda 2 pi square. Sorry, I disappeared the 2 pi over d. Divided by 2 pi over 4 integral of k cubed dk. Right? And this I can write as now I need to take this factor of 2 and combine it here, and I get I lambda pi square over 16 pi to the fourth integral of, sorry, I ignored the k square plus m square d k square, k square, k square plus m square. Okay? Now this is a divergent integral, right? This integral is infinity if we just do it naively from 0 to infinity. If you take this integral from 0 to infinity, you notice this diverge, right? Because at the highest energies, the m square is irrelevant, and you just basically get this integral, right? So, but we already know that my theory is not defined up to infinite momenta. My theory has some cutoff above which I should not trust it. And so, if nothing else, I should not be allowing this integral to go to infinity. I should only allow this integral to go up to my highest momenta, the momenta where I trust my theory. And so if you do this integral, the leading order piece will just be this term, which is I lambda over 16 pi square times lambda square plus term, which go like m square log lambda. Okay. Now, what do I mean by this, by writing that? I mean that the first order term will go like the highest momentum square. Okay, I encourage you to try to do this integral. That's the result of the discovery. The first order term will go as the highest momentum square. The second, there will be subleading effects, subleading divergences that go like the mass of the scalar times log of that high scale. Okay. Now, are there any questions about this result? Because this result is going to be the result that we'll occupy ourselves with the next lecture and a half. So, any questions about how I got there, any of the technical details, what it means? Yeah.
This is not exactly a technical detail, but if you were to do this using dimensional regularization.
We'll do that next, actually. Any questions on how I got this result? Now, what does it mean? What does this result mean? If you ever want to do field theory or quantum field theory, you really should understand this point. What happened here, and what does this result mean? Well, let's ask it a different way. You know, formally, once I send the cutoff to infinity, this result is infinite. That doesn't bother us too much, because what are we going to do next? Where are we going to absorb this infinity into? Or whatever result it is, where are we going to absorb it to? No? Right, so that's exactly why we introduced the counter terms. Because, in fact, the diagrams we wrote above are not the only diagrams. There is one more diagram that I haven't written, which has to do with the counter terms. Right? There is another diagram that looks like this. That just has to do with I delta delta z p square minus delta m. Right? So there is a piece that is just has to do with the counter terms that I can absorb all whatever infinities that I find, I can absorb into the counter terms. So in some sense, this is not troubling at all. What's the big deal? It's an infinity like any other infinity that I encounter, and I'll just absorb it into the counter terms. But it tells me something a little more profound than that. It tells you that you are directly sensitive to the physics, to the scale of the high energy physics. Whatever is going on there, you're directly sensitive to it, and you're not just log sensitive to it. There is a huge difference between being sensitive linearly to something to being log sensitive to it, right? Because if I, how many of you know about the fast Fourier transform? Okay, so for those of you who don't know about fast Fourier transform, so Fourier transforms are very useful, right? How many of you know about Fourier transforms? Hopefully you all know about Fourier transforms. Right, so do you know how many operations does it take to do a Fourier transform? Suppose I give you a data that has 1,000 numbers. Roughly how many operations do you need to do to get the Fourier transform of this data? 1,000 squares. So the Fourier transform goes like the number of operations squared. Now, if you have a million entries, which is not a very large data set, right? A million entries is not very big. You see how what a huge computational cost it is. A million square is a big number, even for modern computers. The fast Fourier transform will do this for you in n log n. So all of a sudden, what was a million, right, 1,000 square, turns into 3,000, right? N log n is roughly 3,000. So if you're actually only sensitive to the log of something rather than to the something itself, that means a very much reduced sensitivity. Okay, it means that you're not really sensitive to that scale very much. In fact, what it really means, if we think about the integral, right, if we think about this momentum integral, what kind of integral will give you a log? So we saw that dk square gives you something that goes like the cutoff square. The kind of integral that will give you a log is dk square over k square, right? This is the kind of thing that will give you log of the cutoff. Now, what does it mean? It means that this sort of function, 1 over x, dx over x, is a very special function, right? Because it's a scale invariant function. It fills all scales in the same way, right? Dx over x, no matter what scale you have, participates in the same way into the contribution. And so that means that log divergences are sensitive to all scales in the same way, democratically. You're not particularly sensitive to the highest scales of your theory. You're sensitive to all scales above it. And so it's a much softer divergence. It's still a divergence. You still have to absorb it into your counter terms, but it's a very different type of a divergence than a quadratic divergence. Okay? And so what we're encountering here at the first order term, we're encountering a quadratic divergence that makes you sensitive to the cutoff. Okay? Now, we'll do this result in probably next lecture already in a different way of renormalizing it. Regularizing it, and we'll get a different answer. And this shouldn't surprise you too much. We'll understand what is the meaning of the different answer. But the reason is because you shouldn't read too much into this answer, right? Because this answer depends on how you regularize your theory, what you decide to do with your high energy scale. But you don't have any information about how you behave in high energy. Right? We don't know what happens at the Planck scale, despite of what some people think. right? We don't really know what's happening there, so we cannot assume that this answer has any meaning beyond just telling us what is our sensitivity. And in fact, in next lecture, we'll see that we get a different answer. We'll understand very precisely why we're getting those different answers and what does it mean to get those different answers. But really, all that you can read from this answer is that you're quadratically sensitive to the high energy scale. Okay? The coefficient is not very relevant. All right, so we'll see more of it next lecture when we do it in a different way. But for now, let's proceed and do the next computation. So this is one answer, right? And let's now do the term which I have as a fermion. So I have the scalar coming in, the fermion coming out, and similarly, I have P. I have the momentum here, P minus K, and the momentum here, K. Right? And so let me just start writing down the different terms. I have IY here. And I have the integral over K. And then I have the two fermion propagators, but you see that they're connected to each other, so I'll basically have a trace of sigma dot, I can do it this way, P plus K, sigma dot K divided by K square minus M square, dot times sigma bar dot P minus K, K square, P minus K square minus M square. Okay? And then I have the second vertex, minus I, Y. The trace is because you're going around in a loop. All right? And you see, this is a slightly more complicated expression, and so we're not going to evaluate the entire thing. I'll just show you a few steps of how you go about evaluating these sort of diagrams, but it's actually not that complicated. And before we jump into evaluating it, let's just try to understand what is the answer we expect to get. Okay, what kind of divergence we're going to get from this, if it's divergent at all. This is called naive power counting. And so let's try to see. Remember, in this diagram, we got a quadratic divergence and we got a log divergence. Let's see what kind of divergences we'll get for this diagram. And we have k in the numerator, and I have two factors of k, so I have at least k square, right? In the propagator, I have two powers, so I get k to the fourth. And then I have the differential d4k. So this is something that looks like d4k over k to the k square. Now, this is precisely the kind of expressions that I had here as well. K to the fourth, d4k over k square. So I can expect that this integral will be as divergent as the previous one, right? This integral is going to go like lambda square plus some other scale. The only other scale here is the mass of the fermion, log lambda. Okay? And in front, I can expect there to be the coupling square divided by 16 pi square. Okay? So without doing too much work, I can already know what to expect. Now, sometimes there are surprises. Sometimes there are some strange, interesting constellations. There are not going to be any constellations this time. This will be roughly the answer we're going to get. And I want you should, whenever you encounter this sort of computation, you should always ask yourself before running, bless you, before running too far into doing the computation, what kind of answer you can expect. Because if you get a different answer, either you made some mistake, or there's some very interesting constellation happening. And often those sort of constellations are a result of some special symmetry. Okay? But in this diagram, again, we expect some sort of quadratic divergence. And in fact, those quadratic divergences will be there for any kind of correction of a scalar. It has nothing to do very much with what's running in the loop. It has more to do with what we are correcting, which is a scalar propagator. And scalars very generally get quadratic corrections to their mass, okay, independently of what it is that's propagating in the loop. So the way we evaluate this is, you mean, like, what do I mean by that, or what is the result?
I mean, we are familiar with how to do gamma matrix, direct convolution.
Right. So it's the same idea. It's just you use the relation that sigma mu sigma bar nu is equal to 2 eta mu nu. And if we are careful about the indices, this is alpha, beta dot, alpha dot. And so there should be a delta alpha dot here. Okay, so if you just commute those things through, but I'm not going to do that. That part is is not in this case it's even trivial because it's just you just get contraction, but in general you just use those relations and you commute through. Okay, so how do you evaluate a diagram like that? There are two major steps that that usually are taken for one loops. So the first we should divide what's happening to the numerator, right, which is just a bunch of sigma matrices, to what's happening with the denominator. The denominator is the more interesting one because the denominator holds the analytic properties of this function, right? It's telling you where the poles are. It's telling you what kind of contributions, what kind of particles are propagating in these diagrams. The numerator is more just telling you about the spinorial structure of this diagram. Okay. So let's just do the numerator first, and then we'll do the denominator. So the numerator is pretty trivial. This trace of sigma dot q sigma bar will just give me something like 2 times k, if I didn't just screw it up, k dot p minus k. Okay, I think there is a factor of 2 in front, but you can check that. All right. So that's as far as the numerator is concerned, but we cannot take it out of the integral because it's a function of k. Right? Depends on k. So we have to keep it for a while. The more difficult part to evaluate is what happens. What do we do with the numerator? So in principle, you could just send it to a computer and ask a computer to do it, and there is a way to do some of those things with computers, or you can rather do some tricks. With the integrals, but there is a very general way of doing those sort of integrals, and is the following. So have you guys seen Feynman parameters? Have you ever seen how to evaluate integrals like that? Okay, so let's just do it once again. So in case you forgot, so let me just collect all the terms. So I have y square, and I just copied the momentum integral. And then I introduce a parameter which runs from 0 to 1, which I'll call x. The numerator I can just copy, 2k dot p minus k. Okay. And what this x does is that it takes these two factors, okay, and allows me to write it as a single propagator. As such, k square minus m square times x plus 1 minus x. Actually, let me call this one x and this one 1 minus x. It's not going to matter, but That's going to make things a little simpler. P minus k square minus m square. And then you close it and square it. So it allowed me to take a product of two denominators and combine them into a single large denominator. Okay? So let me write it here, just in case you are not clear about what is the formula. So if you have A times B, okay, this is equal to the integral from 0 to 1 of x times A plus 1 minus x times B square. Okay? So that's what I've done here. Now, this one you just manipulate, and you bring it to a form which has just the k square in front alone. It takes a little bit of gymnastics because you have cross terms. So let me just now write the integral. I have 2k dot p minus k. But in the denominator, what I'll get is an expression that looks like k square minus 2x k dot p minus m square. Plus x p square minus m square. Okay? So now this is almost useful, but not quite. We need to bring it to a form where the k square stands alone, because that's what I'm going to integrate over. And to do that, what's usually being done is that you shift the momentum. You shift to a, you complete the square. Okay, so you write k prime is equal to k minus xp. And that allows you to get rid of this cross term, k dot p. This k dot p is annoying because it's a cross term and it's harder to integrate it. So we just complete the square to get rid of it. And so you have to do this shift both in the numerator and the denominator. And the answer you'll get should look something like 2 k prime plus xp, 1 minus x p minus k prime. And in the denominator, I now have k prime square minus, open bracket, x times x minus 1 p square plus m square, and then the whole thing squared. Okay, and this is integrated over d4k prime and over x. Okay? And there is a y square in front. Thank you. All right. Now, at this point, we can again use this trick, the weak rotation, to evaluate this integral. And you'll get the same sort of, you can convince yourself now pretty easily, is that you'll get exactly this sort of structure. You'll get lambda square plus term, which goes like log. Right? And this thing you can actually plug into a computer and get the answer. Now, next time we'll do it, we'll actually evaluate both of those integrals in a slightly different way. So I'll leave it here, because next time we'll just start from this integral, and we'll give a general formula for how to evaluate it in what's called dimensional regularization. And the answer is going to look a little different than just the cutoff, and we'll understand what is the meaning of that answer and how to deal with it. Okay? But let's stop the lecture here, where what we have done today is that we set up all the Feynman diagrams, we set up all the rules, and we can start evaluating corrections. And the simplest kind of corrections are to the propagator, and we evaluated for the scalar propagator the scalar self-energy and the scalar with from the fermion loop. Okay, and you see that both corrections give you the same sort of structure, namely quadratic sensitivity to the cutoff. Okay, so let's stop here. And if you have any questions about any, so today was a little more technical in terms of the details and the indices. So if you have any questions on that, just ask me.